Yeah.
A lot of them are very well educated as well, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of them have university degrees. You
yes.
Know, and, right now, well, there's not too many Native people.
Exactly. So.
I mean, like, you know, there's Thomas King, of course, and Emma LaRoche, who should. To me, she should write. She's a powerful writer, you know, like she should, like those are the kind of people I see that could maybe make it into the canon, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, because their subject material might not be acceptable to, maybe big name publishers that we're talking about who also control
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think some texts are making it into the canon, or have made it into the canon, like Maria Campbell's Hatebreed has become sort of a classic. A lot of people read it. Your book is sort of on the threshold to the canon, in that it is being taught in schools and in other countries, and it's read at the universities here too. But it's not, as you said, the big name publishers and both.
It's not the canon as I think of it. I think as the canon has been really exclusive
mm-hmm.
to the major publishers, to the major writers, or you know whom they make. Major writers?
Yeah.
Who
makes major writers?
Generally, most, like, first of all, it starts with the publisher, I think, you know,
mm-hmm.
a publishing company who has experience and know-how and can really market a writer really well, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they have all that, you know, the big publishers. The smaller publishers are often, well, speaking from Pemmican experience, you know,
mm-hmm.
like that was a really young and new publishing house, and with not the access to experienced people that
mm-hmm.
Other publishers have, and a lot of publishers with smaller publishers are generally run by people who are knowledgeable somehow about publishing, who have always been into books and somehow have been involved in literature, right?
Yeah.
And with Pemmican, everybody who's worked there has not had any experience in university credits of,
mm-hmm.
of stuff, you know, to back up their, you know, as a background.
Yeah.
Like I came from a farm and I worked in publishing all of a sudden, you know,
mm-hmm.
with no previous experience at all. So
mm-hmm.
so it's that kind of a background that people at Pemmican generally have. Sue came from a farm too, basically, and
mm-hmm.
and she's, you know, the manager there. Virginia, she didn't, she had worked at Pemmican when I first started there.
Mm-hmm.
She more or less got me on Pemmican, I think. And but before that, she didn't have, you know, publishing experience or anything.
Mm-hmm.
She was, when I was working there, she was just like a accounts receivables clerk kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Bookkeeping and, you know?
Yeah.
So that's who's been running Pemmican.
Yeah.
Compared to Fifth House or, you know,
mm-hmm.
like people like in Talon Books or,
mm-hmm.
you know, like that. So it's. So they do have an advantage, and considering what Pemmican, you know, the people who are running Pemmican's done really well, you know,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
getting books into the educational system as
yeah.
well as, you know, trade books and children's books
yeah.
and all that, you know, so it's, but they'll never be part of the canon.
Mm.
Like, I don't see it, and I don't know if they want to be, because I guess part of that comes to the other question of is the canon exclusive, you know, and it's like all these different Indian groups going to the same funding source for their funding, you know? The bigger and the loudest get oiled, you know, like, and I think the major publishers would be very uncomfortable to have minority presses included. I really feel that. And your other question that you had asked.
You mentioned that, and I was going to ask that again. You said some of them would not even want to be included in the canon. Is that because, say, in this case, native writers write for a native audience to be published through a native press?
I think so. I'm not looking for a big name publisher, like a well-known publisher. I'm thinking, you know, like of my local presses in Winnipeg, more or less.
When you write, do you have a specific reader in mind? Or a specific readership?
Well, for me, I write for Native people now, you know. Like, when I first started writing, I was writing for myself, you know. I wasn't writing to give a message or anything like that. I was just writing for me. And partly for my entertainment, because it wanted to be interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess partly it was therapeutic.
Yeah.
No, I don't think of, like, I'm, even though I don't seem probably in a lot of ways, maybe I don't seem very grassroots, but I am. And I'm not ambitious, which is partly because I never was an ambitious writer.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have gotten schooling and education and stuff like that. And what I was writing on when I started writing was on grade 8 education, you know, like remembering things from that.
Yeah.
And so I never, my readings, you know, like I find, my interest is maintained in a, not in literary types of works, but in a, you know, lower common, everybody's kind of thing, you know, like what interests everybody more or less, you know, that reading level.
We talked about the canon, if we talk about Canadian, are the texts by minority writers that you know sort of specifically Canadian, do you see them as Canadian texts or world literature or just for the community or?
Me.
Yeah, okay, we can switch it off.
No, that's all right. If you don't like anything I said, you can always erase it, which is a nice thing.
I don't even know what I'll use this for. I don't think it'll all be transcribed. It's more sort of for me to remember.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll use something in a classroom or so. But, and if ever I want to use parts of that or use that for a publication, I'd get in contact first so that you can see and rewrite it.
Of course.
Of course, yeah.
So read me your questions.
Yeah. I've got to find them. Yeah, would you like your text included? You answered that?
No.
Who's your audience? What about contact with other writers? Is there networking going on between native writers, between native Indian or Métis writers and, say, black writers or Indian or Chinese?
I think Lenore is more involved in that.
Sorry?
Lenore?
Yeah.
Is more involved in that. there are people who are, you know, really involved in networking and do keep in touch.
Yeah.
And like with each other within the native writing community.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, I think, an attempt to go like with other writers.
Yeah.
Of visible minority, as they say.
Well, which term would you use?
Term?
Yeah, which words would you use? Visible minority is one, writers of color is another one.
I think it confines you when, like I always say, labels.
Yeah.
For instance, like native, you know, like I grew up with native, now it's not really an acceptable word, and everybody jumps on my case about that, but that's what I grew up with, and I'm not being disrespectful when I use it, but.
Well, all these.
Like, I just don't like to think of that. Like, I always say visible minorities, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. You say
kind
that.
Kind of cheap kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's, I suppose it's, if that's what they want, you know, like, I guess.
No, but if you, for example, if you.
I don't know if that's a white term or a term that's acceptable to all visible minorities.
I think all these terms are loaded and charged, and if you use any of them, you're sort of walking trend lines, because they all are being misused, or have been misused, or a term that is acceptable now may be unacceptable tomorrow. So when I use these terms, I always hope they're not offensive. What I'm trying to get at is that in talking to some people,
but that's important
they
too,
said,
where it's coming from.
Yeah. Well, the term minority is a sort of sociological term, right? But under minority, you also call a minority women, because they don't have access to power, not as much. So in sociological terms, minority means a group that is being marginalized. Okay, and now the term visible is, because if you, another term that is used is ethnic minority, but then you have Italians as an ethnic minority in Canada. And what I was getting at with this term was that I think it may be something different if you're white ethnic in Canada, if you're non-white. Because from talking to people, I mean, some people tell me there's a lot of racism here, and that would not be directed against a white person. So that is why I try to find a term, and I don't know which term to use, really. I use them alternatively, and I've also read some books by women of color who use the term women of color and are comfortable with that.
Yeah, I've seen
maybe
that.
That's a better term. I don't know. So
the
writers of color.
People of color. Or
yeah.
Writers of color. I don't
like that term very much, because actually, all these terms in the long run, if you analyze them, they're racist. They become racist.
I think maybe
because
that's
you segment people.
I think maybe that's why I say it with, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of thing. Because I have this intuition that there's something not right with it.
Yeah, I agree.
And a lot of what I think and write and everything and try to figure out things is really based on intuition.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll put, like I'm very often anti certain politician because of intuition, not because of anything I could define. I could point to this and point to that. Another party may have a leader doing the same kind of thing, but I'm really anti that one because of a whole bunch of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can read stuff and my intuition is usually proved right.
I'd like to come back to to that question, though, of terminology, because before you were talking about sort of the canon, mm-hmm. and how...
Which is a kind of a new term.
Yeah, okay. Or say the big house publishing. Let's say if you take big publishing houses like Lawrence and Wishart, MacLeod and Stewart, or University of Toronto Press, or some big ones, or Penguin. And then you take, say, Pemmican and Thetis. Now it would be very difficult to sort of talk about these without using categories and groups. Do you understand what I mean? Because you said you mm-hmm. don't like using sort of these terms, but how are you going to describe the difference? Because there are differences in the people who use them.
Yeah, I'd say the McClellan and them are like major presses, or like the mm-hmm. Better known presses. They're the ones that ambitious writers, want to be published by.
Mm-hmm.
And Pemmican and Thetis are small publishers.
Yeah.
And I would feel, like that the authors there are more grassroots people.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be more comfortable with sort of distinguishing between, say, grassroots writers or grassroots people and established or big name writers?
More comfortable?
Yeah, with the term, because the way I understood you.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure of grassroots. I feel grassroots when I worked at Pemmican. Grassroots.
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted Pemmican to become credible and to become bigger, because one of the advantages that McClellan has, for instance,
mm-hmm.
is their authors are more well known and they're more well read. So when you can get into that perspective, you have a wider, a bigger, a more major audience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a native person, say you're a native writer, and you're published by one of those, then it's really good. I don't see any other native writers that should be jealous of that, because it's really good for the whole native community. And I would support that. I would never put a native writer who's published by a major
mm-hmm.
publisher, because then they have access to more people, and because they're native, whatever they do or say
mm-hmm.
or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Is native, and that's how they feel
mm-hmm.
as native people, and they have a right to feel whatever way
sure.
they want as a native person.
Sure.
So if one of those native people, say, loved Kinsella's work, which is involves that question of appropriation,
mm-hmm.
I feel that person's talking as a native person, they have to, people have to have free choice, on how they feel and everything.
Yeah.
You can't say, because they feel that way, they're anti-native or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or they're backwards
mm-hmm.
or whatever. Because
mm-hmm.
maybe they are backwards, but maybe they'll come to learn and,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And it's just one of the advantages of being published by a big publisher who
yeah.
can really promote you.
Yeah.
But when you are your control too is as a writer is kind of, I think, is probably a little bit more controlled in the way, like, the editor will impose on your writing.
Yeah.
You know, people say, well, you can't say this, this won't be acceptable to the majority of readers, so you should change this paragraph to, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be that, mm-hmm. and that's behind the scenes kind of thing mm-hmm. that people don't think about or mm-hmm. realize.
I think once a writer is established with his name or her name, they can get away almost with anything, because once they've made it in there, if a book is a flop...
They have to make a lot of money for the publisher
yeah.
to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they can, you know, have to have proven themselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
But a brand new, well, not a brand new mm-hmm. native writer, but, you know, a native writer, I think, would feel more pressure.
Yes, yes.
Because there's not, I don't know of too many native writers who have the power to tell their publishers,
no.
you know.
No, that's what I meant, is once somebody is up there and has been up, they can get away, at least for some time. If then the sales go down, they may think twice and say, no, I don't want to publish this. But it's only then, but if somebody sort of gets in there new, be it a native person or any new writer, they'll be much more critical, and I mean the editors, and look at how can we sell this, how can we market it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And that will have implications for what they print or what suggestions they make. Huh?
Yeah. Another thing, though, about native writing, like especially at the small presses, I think is that our books never get remaindered. You know.
What does remaindered mean?
Oh, well, if you go to Cole's bookstores, there's a lot of hardcover books,
see.
You know, that are on that.
On dumping sales.
Cost $30 when it first came out or whatever, and now they're, you know, you can get them for $2.99 or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
So, I don't know of any native books that that's happened to, you know.
Mm.
Because they generally continuously sell, you know,
yeah.
like you can, even if they're slow sellers, you can often.
That's the same,
take
I think.
To the end of a print run,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think that's with any small press or any book that is only printed in so and so many copies. It has to be sold to the last copy in order to make the money that was invested in printing it, if at all.
Yeah.
So there's a big publisher who has so and so many books. Some of them sell fast, sell well, others don't, so he gets rid of the rest, and maybe even makes a deficit on one particular book, but then makes profits on others. And
yeah.
a small publisher just can't do that.
Yeah. Well, Canada too. There's, you know, I don't know what it's like now, but it used to be the grant, you know, the way you got, like, say, Canada Council grants
mm-hmm.
was. It was partially based on sales, but it was also based on expenses. That the more expenses you had, like the more you got.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could have a loss.
Yeah.
Like your income could be less than your expenses, and
yeah.
you know, like it was covered more or less.
Yeah.
And that's how it was based, so that the bigger publishers always got the most money, you know, because
yeah.
they spent the most.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And when I worked at Pemmican, I never had a loss. You know, like we always had profits, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was very rare that we went to, you know, get money for reprints. I don't think I ever got money for reprints when I was there, because we never had a loss
mm-hmm.
on reprints.
Mm-hmm.
And, but because we were a nonprofit organization, our auditor was always telling us, you know, you're going to have to at least break even instead of making profits, because you could lose your status as nonprofit.
Exactly, yeah.
So we had to either, you know, we could increase, eventually we could have increased wages and gotten, you know, either more or really experienced people in, but but there's also a lot of politics, I think, involved in running a publishing house. Well, in my experience, a Métis publishing house.
Now you've moved into film and drama. Do you think you can
I wanted to try to move into film more because I felt there was a wider audience for people watching, you know, like more people watch TV than read books.
Yeah.
And you only pick up books on Native people if you're interested in Native people, you know, or the Native issues. You'll only buy those books if you're interested. But a lot of times you might watch a Native show on TV just because you don't feel like turning the channel, or, you know, CBC is pretty much everywhere across Canada, so Native film on CBC is gets more exposure, you know. Of course, now we have the satellite dishes, so it's not, people don't watch CBC as much.
No, but still.
But there's still a large audience for it, so that part of that was seeing what was on for Native people. Like there was a saying, if you don't like the way somebody does something, do it yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I often try to to live by that, but I mean, I don't get them easy. But it's, I had that kind of an idea, you know, that we need more jobs for Native actors.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have to have good scripts for them. Like, we don't want people being like in that showboat with the black man who had to sing that song, changing words, or, you know, like that. You know, we want them feeling comfortable with what they're, what they're doing. So that was part of it. That was why I suddenly kind of, well, maybe I could get into it, you know. I'm not sure if I can, but if I could, I think I should try.
I think it may also be the only sort of writing and getting published that could make enough money so that people can live on it. Writers can live on it.
That's what
Dan Moses thought yesterday. He said, well, in order to survive, probably one would have to get into film, to say.
Is he earning his...
From his writing, yeah.
Is he writing for film?
Well, he's trying to. He said...
Have you ever met Drew Taylor?
Yeah.
He does quite a bit of film.
Film script writing?
Yeah.
Yeah, he told me, but I have never seen any of his film work.
Oh.
It seems to me that Native people in particular are moving very rapidly into the new media, more so, I think, than mainstream, sort of the general
public. The new media?
I mean, film and even tape recordings of poetry and things like that. And the people I talked to, they all said, yeah, like you said, people don't read books much, but they watch TV or they put on a cassette or something yeah. like that. And that is something, it's almost as if native writers who come sort of into the literary scene very quickly skip the literary part altogether almost and move right into the electronic media.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because that's what they ought to do, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't see myself doing too much of it, because it involves unprivate work.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the kind of person who would be happy to sit in a cabin alone and work at my writing. And work at my writing and not have to have a jam session.
Yeah, I understand.
I enjoy it. You know, I really enjoyed working with Alan Eastman, the Walker script. You know, it was a lot of fun in that. But right now, I feel I want to be alone, like Marlene Dietrich or whoever. But no, I am a lone person, which is why I don't take part in networking, and I never go to things. I never go to readings. Unless I'm doing, I'll do that, but I don't like it, because it reminds me too much of church, you know. Can't stand it. I get so fidgety. And restless, and I can't take anything in. And again, like I said, you know, I'm hard of hearing, so it's very often if there's no microphone, I don't know what they're saying. But
you mean also microphone in the audience for asking questions?
No, for the.
Oh, video. if you're listening.
Like in Oklahoma, you know, I did the reading one night. And I was the first, not the first one, but, you know, up there. And then I got very, very restless. And when I get restless, you know, like when I feel my freedom is deprived, you know, of doing, and I couldn't leave because it would be impolite.
Yeah.
So I had to stay for the rest of the meetings, you see.
Yeah.
And I had known this, but I just got the feeling like I was trapped in church. And because I get that feeling, I just go out. I don't know if it's ever happened to you, but like you get like pinpricks.
Yeah.
Like maybe on a plane or something, you know?
Yeah.
And, anyways, I got like that really, really bad. So I can't stand the theater too. Is I get that feeling too. But theater generally walk out if it's if you're real. Usually the theater I've seen so far has been pretty good, you know. You get that feeling. I forget where the story to talk about, but it's so I was saying I don't go to readings and I don't go to what do they call it? A book launches?
Yeah,
book launches, and because that also involves readings and cocktail things and awards things.
And you actually, if you're quite honest, you don't like what we're doing right now either. It doesn't make you feel relaxed.
Well, it's just between you and me, so I feel fine, you know. And I feel fine in a reading, you know, talking to the audience. I don't care what questions they ask. I feel comfortable.
Maybe it's also because then you are in control, right?
Yeah, probably that.
Maybe not trapped in.
And two, the best part is when it's all over. Like in church, I always used to think, well, this can't last forever, you know, and so that used to, and they had a clock, I think, on the wall or something, you know, but I used to watch.
Yeah,
they had a clock, and I used to watch, and I'd think, well, it can't last forever, you know. So when I'm in a situation, like, they always think, oh, this can't last forever, even if it's a reading and people are asking questions. Because they always think, there are times of stuff so boring, you know, to myself, and I think, oh, the poor audience. You know?
Yeah, but that's because you know your act, right? And you know what you're doing.
Yeah, this happens when I'm doing, you know, like a school, like for 3 days or something, and I got four, you know, six different classes.
Yeah, and you do the, you read the same
stuff. I try not to do that. I try to get them, put them in large groups.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do that because, you know, like Maria Campbell said, you have access to talking to people, then that's good.
Do you mentioned Maria Campbell, do you take like guidance from some native writers, or that you...
Not really.
That you sort of follow their suggestions, not that you go there and ask them, but that you think, okay, she knows what she's talking about, or he knows, and it sounds like a good idea.
In the way that she told me that, like on my first promotion tour.
Yeah.
Like all that was really new, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole thing was. Like I said, I've been living on a farm, isolated, you know, which to me wasn't isolated, but it was, you know, and all of a sudden being there like that and doing interviews on radio and TV and people expecting you to know everything there was to know about all the natives across Canada, you know, Indians and stuff. And, the people I felt most comfortable with were native people, you know. Of course I listened to what Maria had to say because she'd been through it all. And although she'd been through it with McClellan and Stewart, her schedule was a lot more hectic than mine was. But yeah, I thought about what she said, and I thought about what I wished, and then I thought, yeah, you know, I can see it. Although, you know, I wasn't sure I was the best spokesman around for doing that kind of thing, you know, for being a more or less a spokesman for Métis people.
You know, in Night of the Trickster. The topic is rape, and so it's something that is very, unfortunately, very widespread. It concerns a lot of women who are victimized, and perhaps Native women in particular.
Yeah.
Would you see that as part of sort of a general feminist kind of theater, or is it particularly in Native?
To me it's Native. It's not feminist, it's Native, because to me they have this Wendu instructor, and Wendu is supposed to be just for women, with specialized martial arts. It's not karate, it's I don't know what it is, but it's supposedly developed so that women only can use these movements to defend themselves. Okay, so, but that's not what I wanted in my play, because I never took one. I took karate, and I wanted karate in my play, you know? But that was a small part of it, but...
Wendu, do you know how is that, what kind of word is that? I've never heard it, and...
Wendu?
How do you spell that, you know?
W-E-N-D-O.
Okay.
And the director said, wanted the at the end there, he wanted Sam to be doing it too, you know, like clumsily, but to be doing it too, like karate, he could do that.
Yeah.
But she got really, really upset, you know, because it was just for women, and and they keep it really private and everything, and or try to.
Mm-hmm.
They allowed it to be used, like they have a Wendu board of directors. Mm-hmm. They agreed to let her teach the actresses.
The Wendu instructor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I told her, you know, like I'm concerned with the healing of the whole family, because when a woman is raped, it's not just her that's affected, it's her children and her husband. And so it's very important that the whole family
mm-hmm.
be healed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's partly why I shy away from the feminist kind of a thing, because I'm concerned with the whole family, you know, with the children, the women, and the men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, a lot of women will lean towards women issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easy to get caught up in women's issues, like Native women's issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, like I'll write about women.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm not going to not write about women. Mm-hmm. Like I'll write about women mostly, because that's what my feelings are for, you know?
Mm-hmm. But so, you didn't say this, but is the way I understood you, so you'd see that a feminist approach is too much centered just on women and not including the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel that. Like, you know, it's... if you're trying to heal a community, I'm not trying to heal anyone, actually. Like, I'm not one of those, but like with the rape thing, you know, like, although there weren't any children in it, there was a husband in it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, like, they both had to more or less heal, and you know, like, I maybe overlooked the husband's part of it, but with him taking part in that act at the end, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was his contribution, and when you contribute something like that, then there's something that you get back
mm-hmm.
generally, you know, in a general way. Like, if you give something, regardless of whether that particular person gives you back, some, you know, something comes back to you.
Yeah, yeah. I think what you said, from what I've read and what I've heard, I think that probably a lot of Native women feel that way, about sort of about Native issues involving the whole community, the whole family, although very often it's the women who pick it up first, who are the most active, but like, it's not just for women, it's for the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also is sometimes the difference is also the conflict between the feminist movement, which I guess is predominantly white feminist movement, and Native women.
Yeah.
And when I talk about this, my heart goes very fast, because I'm not relaxed about that at all, because I'm European, I'm white, and I'm male, and I'm privileged, right? So I'm really feeling like a voyeurist looking into something that maybe shouldn't concern me. But I just say that I'm aware of these things, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can understand it, and I agree. Although I think some of my colleagues back home, who perhaps are feminists, they would clobber me if they heard me say that.
But if they heard me say that, would they clobber me?
No, they know, but they would see.
Like, they would understand it, right?
I think they would say, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because how can you heal, like, one person in the family?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are a lot of feminists who are also lesbians who don't
mm-hmm.
Have a male figure, mm-hmm. you know, like a man
mm-hmm.
As part of their family. So I can see them being more concerned with, you know, mm-hmm. like the women side of it, because that's their interest, right?
Yeah, but I think the lesbian women, that Native women, but also others, the lesbian women that I know and that I've talked to, very often they are quite less exclusive than some, I say this and that's very unprotected, some middle-class white feminists back home, who you think they'll never look at a man, and then you realize they're married, they have children or so on. I know quite a few lesbians, both of Germans and Maori and Native and African, Canadian and so on, who are quite open and quite inclusive and even relaxed towards me. Mm-hmm. I was quite touched by that because I thought it was so wonderful. There seemed to be a very broad humanitarian aspect, and I talked to some of them. I talked to some about them. They said, "Well, of course we have
to do one other." There, she was totally anti-male.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know, I thought. Well,
yeah. But you see,
so I explained to her, you know, like first I got kind of like sometimes it's too red, you know, I get really angry and I don't control it. And I never yelled at her or nothing. I just explained, you know, very quietly that this is very important, you know, like.
Well, the interrogation isn't over yet.
No, I'm asking them more questions.
We can switch this out.
January.
August 1987. August 1986, that would have been. She died, I think, in January 87.
Yeah, she did. So it was August 80.
And what did she do?
Well, she just came. She said she wanted to meet me. She had written me a couple of times, she would. I think she too had water. And